Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. When we think of examples of leaders with great courage, Sir Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill's name always comes up. He was a visionary war leader, immune from the consensus of the day, who stood firmly for his beliefs even when everyone else doubted him. But where did that political strength and sense of destiny come from? Best-selling author and historian Andrew Roberts has combined decades of research as well as exclusive access to documents never before available to scholars for his latest book, Winston Churchill, Walking with Destiny, a definitive warts-and-all biography from Viking that provides an understanding of the man in revelatory new ways and identifies the hidden forces that fueled Churchill's legendary drive. Andrew Roberts joins us now from England. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be on the show again, Leonard.
There have been 1,009 biographies written of Winston Churchill. What led you to devote your valuable time to writing the 1,010th? Hasn't it all been said by now?
That's a very kind way of putting it. My wife says, what makes you so hubristic as to think that you can impose a 1,010th on the public, which I think would be another way of putting it. But the answer is that since the last major biography of him, and in the last decade, there have been an absolute cornucopia of new sources on Churchill. I was very fortunate that the Queen allowed me to be the first Churchill biographer to be able to use her father, King George VI's diaries, and wartime diaries. And that was great because Churchill met the King and trusted the King, and met him every single Tuesday of the Second World War, and the King wrote down everything that he said. And as I say, he trusted the King with nuclear secrets and the Enigma secret and various other things. And so it was great to have that new source. But since they've also been...
Just let me interrupt for a moment.
Sorry.
Why has it not been available until now? Are there any things in it, the diaries, that would have kept them unavailable for... I think so.
Yes, it's very clear from the King's accounts that Churchill was tremendously frustrated with the Americans for not having got more involved in the Second World War earlier. He saw it as a war for civilization and democracy, and he simply he couldn't understand why the United States was standing, in his view, aloof from it for so long. Really, until Adolf Hitler declared war against you 4 days after Pearl Harbor, did you sort of get involved in the European side of the war? So it was, I think that might have been something that the British didn't really want people to know about too much earlier. Also, of course, they are a private diary of Her Majesty's father, and so we don't have an actual automatic public right to see them until the Queen was happy. And I just happened to be fortunate enough to be the person who, in not taking no for an answer for several years, managed to be the first person in.
And then you said there were some other sources which have not been available for the 54 years after Churchill's death?
Yes, over a century after his death. There have been 41 sets of papers that have been deposited at Churchill Archives in Cambridge University, including his daughter Mary Soames' 1940 diary, and she only died 2 years ago. We've also had, of course, the Ivan Maisky diaries that have been published in Moscow, which he was the ambassador to London from 1932 to 43, saw an awful lot of Churchill during the Nazi-Soviet Pact era, and he wrote down everything that that Churchill said. And we've also got the verbatim accounts of the War Cabinet now. Those have only just been discovered in the last 10 years as well. So, and in fact also the Churchill family very kindly allowed me to see Pamela Harriman's love letters. And she led a very active romantic life in the Second World War, and that's also been a very interesting and amusing new source.
And Churchill, of course, was a prolific writer and journalist. His World War II memoir is 6 volumes, so you had to plow through those again. And in all, he wrote 37 books and hundreds of speeches.
Yes, 900 speeches. But I promise you, it's not a question of plowing through. It was a great pleasure because although he wrote 5.1 million words and spoke 6.2 million words, he could not write or say a boring sentence. He very, very rarely repeated himself. He was, of course, immensely funny. And so you knew that at some stage over the next couple of pages there would be something, there would be an aperçu or there'd be a joke or there'd be something worthwhile and interesting to read. So it really was a great pleasure, in fact.
And he oddly won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Most politicians do not win that prize in 1953 for his mastery of historical and biographical description as well as for his brilliant oratory in defending exalted human values.
That's right. It's a wonderful citation, wasn't it, from the Nobel Committee. They cited 6 of his books in particular, including his wonderful autobiography, My Early Life. And I'm absolutely certain that he deserved it really on literary merit alone, as well as obviously having been instrumental in being one of the people who won the Second World War. These books are superb. They are reprinted constantly for their literary value, I think, as much as for the fact that Churchill wrote them.
He wasn't much of a student or a scholar, so where did that literary ability and drive come from?
The drive, I think, came from a desire to impress his dead father. It's quite extraordinary, the relationship he had with the aloof, mercurial, disdainful Lord Randolph Churchill, who was himself a politician, of course, and a Chancellor of the Exchequer, but who saw no spark of brilliance in his son at all and took really very little notice of him. And he wanted all his life to try and impress his father, although, of course, his father died in 1895 when Churchill was only 20. It was one of the reasons, actually, because he had little money, that he had to write those 37 books. We're very lucky that he was poverty-stricken. And he also was driven by a sense of personal destiny, which is hence the subtitle of my book, Walking with Destiny.
That's a phrase that was in that 6-volume account of the Second World War.
Precisely. You can find it in the last paragraph of the first volume, The Gathering Storm, the first volume of the 6 volumes of war memoirs. And he writes, "I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life had been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." And he did have, in order to understand Churchill, I think it's absolutely essential to appreciate that he did have this incredible driving sense of personal destiny. Even at the age of 16, as a 16-year-old schoolboy at Harrow School, he told his best friend that Britain was going to be in danger in his lifetime, that he was going to be in charge of the defense of London, and he was going to save London and England.
Is it relevant that his mother was an American?
I think so, yes. I mean, it's slightly shocking, really, in a way, because Americans, certainly at that time, had a reputation for American mothers, for loving their children more than the harsh Victorian mothers of the day. But I'm afraid that Jenny Jerome, born in Brooklyn, was not the natural American mother in that sense, because she really took very little notice at all of Winston until in his 20s he became the trustee of her trust, at which point she took a lot of notice of him. But prior to that, in 1884, for example, we know from her diary that in those 6 months, she only saw her son for 6.5 hours.
So he was trying to prove himself to his mother as well as his father.
Exactly. Who lived for much longer. She lived at least into her 60s, whereas her father died when he was 45. And she was an important force. He says in My Early Life that she shone for me like the evening star, brilliant but at a distance. I think it's one of the saddest sentences in the whole book.
Did he have a number of brushes with death as a young man and then again throughout his life?
A truly extraordinary number. He was born 2 months premature at Blenheim Palace, of course, the grandson of the Duke of Marlborough. He was stabbed in the stomach at the age of 10 with a penknife. He was nearly died from pneumonia at the age of 11 when the doctors gave the 11-year-old brandy, both orally and rectally, which you would have thought might put you off brandy for life, but it didn't in Winston Churchill's case. He nearly drowned in Lake Geneva, age 16. He nearly died in a house fire. He was very nearly killed on 5 occasions with 2 plane crashes and 3 car crashes. And there was a famous occasion on Fifth Avenue and 76th Street when he was run over by a car and also very nearly killed, hospitalized for some weeks. And that's only in peacetime. You know, he also took part in 5 campaigns on 4 continents.
He joined the British Army when he was young, and he saw action in India, the Anglo-Sudan War, the Second Boer War. Any others?
Yes, he went off to watch the Cuban insurrection against the Spanish in 1895, not as a fighting officer, but as an observer. And that was the first time he heard bullets fired in anger. He said that it was the most exhilarating feeling in the world is to be shot at without result. And then in the Great War, of course, in World War I, he became a lieutenant colonel after he was forced to resign after the catastrophe of the Dardanelles campaign. I'll explain that in a second. But he went off and went into no man's land no fewer than 30 times in the course of the 6 months that he was serving in the trenches, and got so close to the German trenches he could actually hear them speaking. He didn't need to do that. He was a battalion commander. He could have stayed back at battalion headquarters. But he wanted to see what the men were seeing right up front.
How did he come to be a war correspondent?
Sorry, I didn't catch the last word. What did you say?
How did he come to be a war correspondent? So here he is, a young man who is in the military and seeing action. But at a certain point, he actually winds up writing about it for newspapers.
Yes, he started. Well, this was again because he was very largely broke, not just because his father didn't leave him very much money, but also because he was a huge spender all the way through his life. He loved spending money, always went for the best of everything, and always believed that the best way to try and make the books balance was not to save any money, but just to earn more. And he wound up being the best paid war correspondent in the world at the time of the Boer War. But it was very much as a way of keeping ends meeting.
And did the fame that he gained by that lead him into entering politics?
It was really the fame that he gained by escaping from a prisoner of war camp, the Boer prisoner of war camp, after his armored train had been ambushed by the Boers at the beginning of the South African War, that catapulted him into fame. And it happened in a terrible week when the British lost 5 battles in 1 week. And so the editors were desperate for good news, and Winston Churchill escaping from his prisoner of war camp and then crossing 300 miles of enemy territory was just the kind of good news story that they needed.
I was thinking about that brandy story again and his upbringing and the image that a lot of people have of him as being a depressive and an alcoholic.
Well, I don't believe he was either of those things. He certainly got depressed. Of course, he got terribly depressed. We mentioned the Dardanelles catastrophe, which in the First World War, which had led, but largely his baby, that one, and his project, and it had led to disaster. So he got depressed then. He also got depressed in the Second World War and some of the occasions, like the fall of Singapore or the fall of Tobruk. But those are occasions that anyone would have got depressed. I don't believe he had Black Dog, which is the words that he, on only one occasion in his life, used in a letter to his wife, at a time when the phrase actually also meant, it was a word that Edwardian nannies used to describe ill-tempered children. And he also chaired, in the Second World War, over 1,000 meetings of the Defense Committee of the War Cabinet at all times of day and night, which would have been next to impossible if he'd had a really serious chemical imbalance, which such as manic depression, let alone bipolar disorder, which I've seen in some biographies have claimed he had. So I'm a skeptic about the idea of him being a depressive.
Well, it's always difficult to psychoanalyze someone long after he's dead.
And one never wants to sort of write psychobabble either terribly much. And so, if anything, one must always err on the sort of conservative side when it comes to these things in biographies, it strikes me. But nonetheless, there's also a good deal of medical support for that, for my theory. Most recent writing on Churchill's so-called depression do support my thesis on it. With regard to his alcohol consumption, he did drink an enormous amount. There's no doubt about that. But he also had the most extraordinary capacity for it. There's a marvelous line of the journalist C.P. Scott who knew Churchill and said that Winston Churchill couldn't have been an alcoholic because no alcoholic could have drunk that much. and when one looks at the diaries of the people around him in the Second World War, which went on for 2,900 days, they never once, apart from on one occasion in March 1944, do they say that the Prime Minister was drunk. And I think that's extraordinary considering the amazing pressures and stresses on him.
I'm speaking to historian Andrew Roberts about his latest book called Winston Churchill, Walking with Destiny, available in this country by Viking. Already a bestseller in Britain?
It is, yes, absolutely. And it's been a bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list for 8 weeks, I'm thrilled to say.
I'm so pleased that we were able to talk to you today on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. When he got involved in politics, he entered Parliament as a conservative and then defected to the Liberal Party just 4 years later. Why?
Free trade. The Conservative Party moved against free trade in favor of the policy of imperial protection. And he thought that this was a disaster, that the whole basis of British 19th century prosperity was based on the free trade that they had adopted at the time of the repeal of the Corn Laws in the 1840s, and thought that it would be a disaster.
We're still debating those kinds of things today.
All the time, yes. Well, especially my parliament, of course, England, at Westminster, over the last week has been talking about pretty much nothing else.
And interestingly, Winston Churchill had proposed at a certain point that Europe come up with an equivalent to the United States, the United States of Europe, and now Britain is moving in totally opposite direction.
Well, that's right. He was very much the founder of the European movement. He never wanted, as he said, Teuton to fight Gaul ever again, never wanted to see the French and Germans fighting each other, which, of course, twice in his lifetime he had seen, and he'd lost very many friends as a result of that. But when one looks closely also at the wording of his speeches, and certainly what he did when he was Prime Minister from 1951 to 55, when he kept Britain out of the Iron and Steel Confederation and the European Army and any other pan-European organizations, it's quite clear that although he very much wanted to have a United States of Europe, he did not want Britain to be part of it.
So he wanted Britain to work in cooperation with it, which is the way things worked out until Brexit.
Until 1975, when we joined the European Union. That was the moment that we went into a different direction from the one that Churchill wanted.
Was his defection to the Liberal Party, which is what, the year 1904 or something like that, was that a good political move?
It really was, as far as he was concerned, yes. And, of course, as a result, he was attacked violently by the Conservative Party because they went into opposition in 1906, after the general election of 1905, and stayed out of government for 10 years. So people did think that he was sort of jumping, or a rat leaving the sinking ship, as it were, and he was accused of that and an awful lot more, especially later on in his career when he went back into the Conservative Party.
Was he welcomed back? That was 20 years later.
It was 20 years later. He was welcomed back by a large number of the rank and file, but the people who were actually sitting in the House of Commons in those 20 years, who had been attacked and wittily crushed and been the butt of his ripostes over two decades, didn't quite see it in the same way.
Well, he held any number of governmental positions as a member of the Liberal Party. He was president of the Board of Trade from 1908 to 1910, then the Home Secretary from 1910 to 1911, the first Lord of the Admiralty from 1911 to 1915. And what role did those early governmental positions play in shaping his later political career?
Well, you'll remember earlier I talked about how he said how all my past life has been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial. Those roles that you just enumerated there were absolutely central to the way in which he was able to present himself as a credible alternative prime minister to Neville Chamberlain in May 1940. Because as First Lord of the Admiralty, he, of course, took on the same role at the beginning of the Second World War. But at the time before the First World War, he managed to get the Navy ready for the conflict. He turned it from a coal-fired, coal-powered navy to an oil-powered navy. He was able to bring in all of the latest and most impressive armaments. And so he set us up, really, for having the kind of navy that we needed in order to beat the Germans in the First World War.
Was he a bit of a liberal in his time? I know he's a member of the Liberal Party, but I mean liberal in the other sense. Didn't he support prison reform and workers' social security?
Very much. He was the founder, along with David Lloyd George, of the welfare state in the United Kingdom, bringing in the National Insurance Act and the other major acts that underpinned the British welfare state. And he did that as a liberal. And of course, he was, when he was Home Secretary, he was very keen on penal reform. He was the only Home Secretary in British history who'd actually been in a prison as a convict, as a prisoner, in this case, obviously, actually a prisoner of war. And so he sympathized hugely with them and with the prisoners and did a lot of good for them and said, made a great speech. It's in the book. I can't remember the exact wordings, but basically the gist was that a society needs to be judged on the way in which it treats its prisoners.
Although later he is a victim of the move toward more of a welfare state, but we'll get to that in time.
Yes, that was not so much the liberal welfare state as, of course, the socialist labor welfare state after the Second World War.
The reason that he returned to became a Tory again was because because Labour then became the most important opposition party.
Precisely, absolutely.
For all of his strengths, is it fair to say that Churchill was very much a flawed person? He made any number of a lot of beyond personal mistakes.
He just got so many things wrong. I mean, we've mentioned, of course, the Dardanelles.
Let's talk about that a bit more. That was during the First World War when he ordered. When he was first Lord of the Admiralty, what did he do?
Well, he came up with this genius idea. It was a genuinely brilliant idea of trying to get the Royal Navy through the Dardanelles Straits and therefore moor it off Istanbul, then called Constantinople, and basically force the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, out of the First World War, which, had it come off, would have been one of the greatest coups in the history of warfare. But unfortunately, the implementation of the operation, which he wasn't present for, of course, he was back in London, but the admiral's implementation went badly wrong. We lost six ships. The Allies lost six ships in the course of one day on the 18th of March, 1915. And then, due to Churchill's prompting, we landed a large force on the Gallipoli Peninsula on the European side of the Straits in order to try to capture them. And that, too, was a disaster and ultimately led to the killing or wounding of 147,000 Allied troops. So this was something that was held against him, understandably, I think, for a very long time. People still shouting at him in the 1930s in his public meetings, what about the Dardanelles? But as you said, he's a flawed character. He got lots and lots of things wrong. He had two-thirds of a century in the House of Commons, and he managed to get very important issues like women's suffrage wrong. He got the gold standard wrong when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, went in at the wrong time, the wrong price. He managed to get the abdication crisis wrong, supporting the King, Edward VIII, against pretty much everybody else.
How did he get
wrong? Because he was a friend of the King, and he was a monarchist who, his wife Clementine said, he believed in he was the last great believer in the divine right of kings. He was very reactionary in that sense, and he didn't believe that Parliament really had the right to take an anointed monarch's throne, which was very old-fashioned even for 1936. Well, in each of these things, each of these terrible mistakes that he made, the one thing about them is that he learned from them, which isn't always the case with politicians, and it was with Churchill. With the Dardanelles, he never once overruled the chiefs of staff in the whole of the Second World War. And so he wasn't just a politician who went on making the same mistakes. He did actually learn from them.
But I want to talk about some more of the mistakes. The deployment of the Black and Tans to post-1918 Ireland when he was Secretary of State for War.
Appalling mistake. He didn't believe that, it's the old story with Ireland, you know, that the six counties in the north, who were mainly Protestant, didn't want to become part of the same nation as the 26 counties in the south. And were willing to fight to prevent it. And Churchill believed that the whole of the island of Ireland could continue to stay in the British aegis and the British Empire. And he sent in the 1920s sent a lot of ex-army real thugs, frankly, who got into a bruising war against the IRA and employed terror against the IRA's terror tactics. And at one point, about half of Cork was burnt down as a result of the Black and Tans. And Churchill not only sent them in, but also continued to support them. And so that is, yes, absolutely another of the great mistakes he made. But as he said in a letter in 1916 to his wife Clementine, I should have made nothing if I had not made mistakes.
Well, then he took a hard line against India's independence movement, so he was at least consistent. But he said some particularly nasty things about Mahatma Gandhi.
He did, yes. He was his speech where he called Mahatma Gandhi a half-naked fakir striding up the steps of the Viceregal Palace to parley on equal terms with the representative of the King Emperor, i.e. the Viceroy, was one of the more notorious phrases that he employed against somebody who today, of course, we do see as a kind of secular state, saint. There are problems with this, of course, not least because of some of the things that Gandhi said about Mussolini and about black people in South Africa and about congratulating Adolf Hitler on his victory in May 1940 and so on. But at the time, nobody knew about any of that, and Churchill very much seemed as though he was speaking for the most reactionary wing of the Conservative Party that there was.
Was he blind to the implications of those notions about race and colonialism?
Yes, he was. It's very difficult to, in our age today, I think, to remember that he was born in the same, he was born whilst Charles Darwin was still alive, and it was extraordinary how many people, however ludicrous and obscene we think it today, an awful lot of people thought that a hierarchy of races was actually scientific fact. It was truly extraordinary when one thinks how far we've come in the intervening decades.
There are still people who believe in eugenics to this very day. So, although they probably weren't calling it eugenics then.
No, they did. They had a eugenics conference. It was called the Conference on Eugenics back in, I think, 1908.
Wow.
It was seen as an offshoot of science as opposed to what we now regarded as a completely unacceptable act of ignorance and bigotry.
Another one of his mistakes that has been cited was his role in the siege of Sydney Street in 1911, where two Latvian revolutionaries try to pull off a jewelry robbery?
Three of them. They never found the body of the last one, but they only managed to find the corpses of the first two. Yes, I think this is people are a bit harsh on this. Really, he was Home Secretary. He obviously didn't need to go to the place where it was all taking place in Sydney Street in the East End of London. But he was drawn. First of all, he was drawn to action throughout his life. Always wanted to be at the place where the action was taking place. But also, he was Home Secretary. He was able to oversee, come up with a couple of good ideas about the protection of the policemen and soldiers who were surrounding the house that the Latvian anarchists were in. And so I think the attacks on him were a bit over the top, frankly. There are many things he's guilty of, but I don't think that really should be one of the more serious ones, certainly.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large, one of Churchill's most famous speeches, although he made quite a few. Winston Churchill is the subject of Andrew Roberts' latest book called Winston Churchill, Walking with Destiny, available in the United States from Viking. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. You mentioned earlier that Churchill was frustrated by the reluctance of the United States to enter World War II. But didn't he, he was kind of isolated in Britain when he opposed the appeasement of Hitler and said it was bad policy. So wouldn't he have understood why American isolationism was happening?
He understood it intellectually, but emotionally he felt that the Americans were dragging their heels and that if they had had a more active foreign policy, there was a chance that even the Second World War might not have happened in the first place. He was somebody who was a great internationalist, of course, with regard to this. He thought the decision of the United States not to take part in the League of Nations in 1920 was a catastrophic historical error, and said so. But you're quite right. I mean, compared to the frustration he felt about the Americans not getting in more anti-Hitler in the 1930s, it's nothing compared to the frustration and anger that he felt about the successive British governments not rearming and being able to protect the United Kingdom from Hitler and the Nazis.
Why was it that he, first and foremost among British politicians in the 1930s, was able to see appeasement of Adolf Hitler as bad policy? And was that hurting his political career at the time?
His political career was, for all intents and purposes, over by the time of his resignation from the Shadow Cabinet in 1931, January 1931. He was turned down for future office by three successive prime ministers, and so he had very little to lose in his denunciations of Hitler and the Nazis. But I think that the way in which he became the first major British politician to denounce them, and for very much of the 1930s, really the only prominent British politician to denounce them, stemmed from three things. The first was his sense of history. He was able to place the hegemonic ambitions of Germany and Hitler in that period in the long British continual tradition of standing up against would-be hegemons. Philip II of Spain, of course, Louis XIV of France, Napoleon, the Kaiser, and now Hitler. The second thing was he was a Philo-Semite. he liked Jews. He had grown up with Jews. His father liked Jews. He'd represented Jews in his constituency. He believed that Jews gave the ethics for Western civilization. And he could therefore have an early warning system when it came to Hitler and the Nazis that was denied, frankly, to an awful lot of the anti-Semites who sat on the same benches as him, people from his own age and class and background. And you also get very much a sense of his having looked fanaticism in the eye in his early part of his career fighting in Africa and Asia, and he saw the same kind of thing in the Nazis.
Well, the and Boers actually were supported Hitler during World War II, or the lead up to World War II.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, it was very, very close. The vote went 80-67 in the South African Parliament about whether or not they were going to join the Allies at all, and it was so it was a pretty close run thing.
But Churchill was also described as loving war.
Horrible fact, and something that he actually admitted to in a conversation with a friend, Margot Asquith, the wife of the Prime Minister, on a couple of occasions right at the beginning of the First World War. But it wasn't the it was the action and the excitement and the importance of the history of it. You know, he knew that it would be spoken of in 1,000 years, these great wars of the 20th century. It wasn't the actual death and destruction that he loved at all. He'd come up close with that. He'd seen so many of his friends and his school friends killed in the Great War and in the Boer War. There was no way that he loved the ghastly, violent side of war, but he did get excited by it compared to the relatively, boring job of a peacetime minister.
So he liked the excitement of being in the middle of the action.
In the Blitz, he used to go up onto the Air Ministry roof and actually watch the London Blitz taking place. He was incredibly brave of him.
Instead of going into a bomb shelter,
he hated the bunker. He only went down into the Number 10 Annex bunker. He only slept there 3 nights of the whole war. Otherwise, his thing was always to get as close as possible to the action.
He also took transatlantic trips during the war, and there were German U-boats threatening pretty much all British ships.
Well, that's right, and he got hit by lightning on one of the return flights coming over the Atlantic. If the instrumentation had gone down, he would have gone down with it. He actually travelled 110,000 miles outside the United Kingdom during the Second World War. And this allowed him, of course, to be the glue that kept the big three together, Roosevelt and Stalin and he. Roosevelt, of course, was profoundly disabled, although he did manage to come to 4 conferences outside the United States. And then Stalin only left the Soviet Union once during the war. He didn't like traveling, and he certainly didn't like flying. So it was it really took Churchill to bond the three of these men together by making these trips to Washington, 2 trips to Moscow, went off to Yalta and Tehran and so on. And he had for many of the trips he was within the radius of the Luftwaffe. And these, of course, were in unpressurized cabins when he was in his late 60s, early 70s. It was a really tremendous aspect of the war effort as far as he was concerned.
What did you learn about his relationship with President Roosevelt?
But of course, it was personally close. They came from the same kind of aristocratic background of their own countries. They did like each other, and so that side of thing was genuine. Sometimes you find in these great power connections that it's not genuine at all. But actually, he was as nice behind Roosevelt's back. He was to his face. Not always, actually. Sometimes he was highly critical of things to the king that the king wrote down in the diaries. But those were mainly political. They weren't really personal things about Roosevelt. But by the time, one thing that surprised me was that really by the autumn of 1944, that close personal relationship had broken down, and there are over 200 more letters written by Churchill to Roosevelt than there are replies from Roosevelt. There are so many things that they disagreed with over.
Such as?
Towards the end of the war. Well, such as policy, say, towards Greece or Italy. Big issues there that the United States didn't want to take active involvement in attacking the Greek communists, for example, whereas Churchill certainly did. And these issues started, as you can imagine, naturally would affect the overall chumminess of the relationship.
Well, there were the whole matter of the alliance with the Soviet Union, and that had to be considered what was going to happen post-war. In 1946, he warned about the threat of Stalin and Soviet communism, but hadn't he said earlier that he liked Stalin?
Yes, that was another surprise for me. The way in which he managed to create a pretty close personal bond with somebody who has to go down as one of the most unpleasant people in modern history. Stalin, even though he knew that Stalin had been responsible for the Katyn massacre and so many other horrific crimes, he was able to have a pretty good, close, personal working relationship with him. They stayed up one night in October 1942 drinking into the early hours, and they frankly got on with like a house on fire. Now, of course, it was very much in Britain's interest at that time that we did get on well with the Soviet Union, and he was capable of doing things for his country that he wouldn't necessarily otherwise do in a social situation, just like any great leader is. But nonetheless, it does come as a surprise when he says privately that he likes Stalin.
He was voted out of office in 1945 in favor of labor and a welfare state. You would have thought after his having led Britain through the war that he would have been reelected. What happened?
Well, the electorate by then, he was re-elected, of course, in his own constituency, but he was only on the ballot paper in one constituency out of 650, and the electorate remembered that the Conservative Party had been great supporters of appeasement before the Second World War, and they also wanted the various things that the Labour Party had on offer, like the National Health Service and the welfare state, which the Conservatives would go along with, at least in their manifesto, but obviously didn't have their hearts in it in the same way that the Labour Party did. So he was swept away by that landslide, and his wife that day, when it was clear that it was going to be a Labour landslide, said that she thought that, in fact, it would be a blessing in disguise. And Churchill replied, well, from where I'm sitting, it seems to be quite effectively disguised.
Did he?
Although, in a sense, it was a blessing in disguise, because he was exhausted by the end of the war, and had he stayed in power, there's a very good chance that his health would have completely broken down.
Well, he came back into power as Prime Minister in 1951. Did he embrace the changes that Labour had brought about?
Yes,
during the next, he served for 4 years.
He served for 4 years. There was no attempt to dismantle the welfare state. They didn't denationalize the Bank of England or any of the, they didn't try to take mines back into private ownership or anything like that. There was no privatization program. And so what he effectively did was to allow that to become part of the British tradition, which it stayed really up until the advent of Margaret Thatcher in the early 1980s.
At that point, Britain had to realize it was no longer a major world power, and it began to lose its colonial empire. How did he deal
not
with
during
that?
Not during his premiership. There was no part of the empire that was given back when he was prime minister. You'll
right.
remember the famous speech in December.
Right, 48 is Sorry. India and Pakistan, which is
yes,
4 years after he left.
That's right, and Ceylon and now Sri Lanka. And then in the late 1950s, most of the African colonies were given independence. So it was it was a sort of his period in office was the bit where nothing back was given back. It was he who said in 1942, of course, I did not become the King's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. And he kept that promise both in that premiership and in his subsequent peacetime one.
Did he drop out of leadership after he stopped being prime minister in, what was that, 55?
55, April 55, yes. Well, he was 80 years old by that stage. And so although he made speeches and people enjoyed listening to him and seeing him in the House of Commons, he didn't have that long. He needed to write the history of the English-speaking peoples, which took up a lot of his time. Of course, he needed to... and then he really enjoyed himself. He bought 37 racehorses, and finally he'd come into money because he'd been broke all his life. As I mentioned earlier, he was a huge spender. But then when he signed his war memoirs, the contract for his war memoirs, he was very rich for a period and was able to enjoy his retirement until, unfortunately, he started to contract senile dementia in the early 1960s.
And died in 1965. One surprising aspect of his personality was how easily he could be brought to tears. Do we have any idea why?
Well, he was a profoundly emotional man. He was driven by his passions, and you're right. On no fewer than 50 occasions during the Second World War, he burst into tears, but people recognized that he wasn't the... And in the researches for my book, I was reminded of this constantly. He wasn't the buttoned-up English aristocrat of the late 19th century, that the stiff upper lip kind of person at all. He was, if anything, a throwback to a Regency period, a romantic figure of an aristocrat, still, of course, of the Regency period, the kind of man who did buy 37 racehorses. But he was not this sort of typical figure of his age, which, of course, was tremendously lucky, especially in the 1930s, when he showed the perversity of standing up against Hitler and the Nazis.
His name is often evoked in times of crisis in both Britain and this country. What are people looking for that from him that they're not getting from other leaders?
I think several things, really. Tremendous moral courage. I mentioned how he was standing alone for very much of the 1930s. It was more than that. He was shouted down in the House of Commons. He was reviled in the newspapers. He was nearly deselected from his seat by the Conservative Party. He was sneered at and ignored and ridiculed. And yet he did not change his stance on what he truly believed about Hitler and the Nazis. If anything, it drove him on further. He never employed a spin doctor. He wrote all his own speeches. He never took any notice of focus groups or opinion polls. You knew from Winston Churchill what you heard was what came straight from him, and he believed it. And so I think that's something that's very attractive, especially vis-a-vis a lot of modern politicians. Also, as well as his moral convictions, he had this tremendous eloquence. We mentioned earlier, when you played that piece from the June 1940 speech, I had tingles going up and down my spine the entire recording there. He had this amazing eloquence, his capacity, largely because he was a writer and a journalist, to summon up phrases that will live as long as the English language does. So that was also something that I'm afraid I don't see very much of in our modern politics. And also foresight. You mentioned briefly about his Iron Curtain speech in Fulton, Missouri, but also his warnings before both the First World War and the Second World War, showed that although he did make these terrible errors, one after the other, and we've gone through most of them, but there are more, he nonetheless, when it came to the really important things of the 20th century, he tended to get them right. And so that's also something I think that we look for in our politicians, but rarely find.
I neglected to ask you about what you learned from Ivan Maisky's memoirs of his time in London. in the, I guess, the early years of the war, World War II. Did he admire Churchill?
He did admire Churchill, yes. He didn't want to. He didn't start off admiring Churchill. He began as an admirer of David Lloyd George and some other politicians. But he was brought round to admiring Churchill. And, of course, they did have this quite strong bond in that Churchill was quite willing to completely kick over the traces. And even though he had been the most aggressive anti-Bolshevist from the time of the Russian Revolution on up until the mid-1930s, when he spotted that Hitler was the greater threat to world peace than the than Stalin, he was willing to bring Stalin into what he called a grand alliance against Hitler, and therefore sort of turn on his head all of his great anti-communist speeches, although he said, of course, he didn't resile from a single word of them. But he understood that the greater issue now was to try to stop the Nazis, and so these diaries of Ivan Maisky have got many fascinating aperçus into Churchill's thinking at that time.
There have been a number of movies recently, in which Churchill is either the key figure or at least plays a part in the story. When did the legend turn totally in his favor? He has been voted Person of the Century, a Man of the Millennium. In 2002, the BBC Two audience voted him the greatest Briton of all time.
Yes, it hasn't always been like that at all. In fact, of the last four movies, only really Darkest Hour, this one that you mentioned, the Gary Oldman movie, where I thought Gary Oldman did a wonderful job in... capturing that sense of Winston Churchill. He looked just like him,
yes,
with the prosthetics. He also caught that sort of the twinkle in his eye, which was essential to Churchill. The one scene that grated with me, of course, was the one where he went onto the subway and used the British people as a kind of focus group for fighting on against Hitler. The truth is very different. He actually decided himself, without any focus group or advisers or anything, that he believed that Britain needed to fight on and not make peace with Hitler in May 1940. And he certainly didn't need any focus group to help him with that. And it was his leadership that therefore, in fact, brought the British people round rather than the other way round.
Andrew Roberts' biography of Winston Churchill is Winston Churchill, Walking with Destiny. It's published in this country by Viking. And what a great pleasure it's been talking with you today.
You are kind, Leonard. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
And congratulations on the success of the book. And let's hope that this stops the little industry of Churchill biographies for a while. It is, as I said earlier, the 1,010th book about Winston Churchill.
I don't think so. There'll be a short hiatus and then we'll be back to the races again.
That brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Andrew Roberts, to Todd McGovern, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lint. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.